You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 8th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and from just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show...
What probably the US administration is going to push for is to minimize the damages, to jeopardize US-Israeli relationship to a minimum level.
From that back room in Geneva to front pages here in London, we'll review the day's top news stories with George Brock and Matthew Jameson. Then we head to the Monocle Cafe to meet Korean director Kim Dong-ho, founder of the Busan Film Festival. And British DJ Rob DeBank joins us on the eve of a major new electronic music festival.
Yeah, there's some club culture, there's a lot of gigs. It's going across all the media, so hopefully it's not too intellectual, it's not too highbrow, but it's not just clubs and banging raves.
All that ahead of us, plus a bit of our own music too, and we look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo, coming up with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to get stuck into here during the next hour before we begin. Let's catch up with the latest world news. Here's Jonathan Wheatley.
US Secretary of State John Kerry has joined international talks on Iran's nuclear program. The United States has offered to ease sanctions on Iran if the country takes concrete, verifiable steps to show it's not developing nuclear weapons. But Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned that Tehran is offering false concessions.
This proposal would allow Iran to retain the capabilities to make nuclear weapons. Israel totally opposes these proposals. I believe that adopting them would be a mistake of historic proportions. They must be rejected outright.
Yet the White House spokesman, Jay Carney, was more optimistic. But even he said Iran cannot have nuclear weapons.
The diplomatic resolution to this challenge is obviously preferable. But there is a limited window of opportunity here. So we're taking advantage of a new level of seriousness that we've seen to engage in negotiations. But we are doing it in a way that makes clear that actions are what matter.
12 million people in the Philippines are thought to be at risk as a powerful typhoon strikes across the country. Winds of nearly 200 miles an hour were reported as Typhoon Haiyan made landfall. Three people are known to have died. At least 1 million have been evacuated and communications have been badly disrupted. Germany and Brazil have submitted a resolution to the UN General Assembly calling for an end to invasive internet scrutiny and other invasions of privacy. It follows revelations about a US-led spying program, including claims the phone calls of both countries' leaders were intercepted. Germany's ambassador to the United Nations, Peter Wittig, says it's a cause of alarm around the world.
Where do we draw the line between legitimate security interests and the individual right to privacy? And how do we ensure that human rights are effectively protected, both online and offline?
The Dutch king, Willem Alexander, has arrived in Moscow ahead of a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, as ties between the countries have been tested by the arrests of Greenpeace activists and also Russia's homosexual propaganda law. The 18th of September protest off the Russian Arctic coast against oil drilling there has strained relations between Moscow and The Hague. The Netherlands is seeking the release of the 28 Greenpeace activists and two journalists from pre-trial detention. The German government is facing renewed calls for greater transparency after the discovery of more than 1,000 artworks looted by the Nazis. Works by Picasso and Matisse are among the haul found in an apartment in Munich last year. But art historian Jonathan Petropoulos questions why it's taken so long to get the works back to their original owners.
Survivors are dying every day. The next generation is still with us, but they won't be for too much longer. And so these delays have real implications. And these are special kinds of objects for these people. And to the extent that we can undertake the restitution of the works that were stolen from Holocaust victims, you know, we should do that as quickly as possible.
And finally, the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, known for making gaffes, rang the wrong Marty Walsh to congratulate who he thought was the Democratic candidate for mayor after winning the job for the city of Boston on Tuesday. Another Marty Walsh reported that the vice president told him, and Tom, this is my best American accent, "Congratulations, Marty, you son of a gun, you did it." He calmly replied, "I said, Mr. Vice President, you have the wrong Marty Walsh." And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Lovely stuff. That was the news with Jonathan Wheatley. You get a lot of bang for your buck with Mr. Wheatley. Not just the news, but a little bit of Amdram there at the end as well, Jonathan.
What can I say, Tom?
Very, very much appreciated as always. And if you want to hear more from Jonathan Wheatley, you're in the right place. He'll be back at the bottom of the hour with more news and who knows, maybe some more impersonations for us as well. You're with Aperitivo here on Monocle 24 and we'll be back just after this.
From London
to Zurich
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Beijing
nach Amsterdam
to Bogota.
This is Monocle 24.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo. The time here in London is 6 minutes past 1800 hours, 1306 in New York City. I'm delighted to say that joining me now in the studio with their take on the news is George Brock, head of journalism at City University London and author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. I think that book may be relevant to one of our topics later, George. And alongside him also Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI, Royal United Services Institute, of course. Welcome to you both. Delighted to have you with us on the programme again. Let's start today in Iran. Hopes are high, of course, for a deal over the country's nuclear programme. US Secretary of State John Kerry cut short his Middle East tour to join ongoing negotiations over Iran's nuclear ambitions in Geneva, where the five permanent members of the Security Council have gathered alongside Iran. Now, whilst Kerry this afternoon has said that important issues remain unresolved, the Israelis obviously not best pleased, I think it's safe to say, hints perhaps that some solution may be closer. Matthew, what do you make of all this? Do you think people are always desperate to find some sort of olive branch, something positive to cling on to? Are there genuine causes for optimism here, or should we be rather more circumspect?
I think that we have to be very, very sceptical, first of all. We've been around the table with Iran many, many years now. This has been going on. And it would be great to get a breakthrough, and hopefully we might get a breakthrough. But we need to really just keep our expectations pretty low, I think. It's going to be very complex because I was in Israel this week, and in all my discussions with the diplomats and parliamentarians there and all other national security and military figures, they were absolutely adamant that they will not tolerate a nuclear-armed Iran. And they're just very, very clear on that. They also feel as though that this is a bit of a charade, what the Iranians are doing to try to get sanctions lifted. And it seems to me from what I've read so far that there's not really any substantive concrete agreement that would reassure them. So we have to wait and see, really.
It's always a bit of a waiting game, isn't it, George? I wonder, what do you make? Do you sort of share that sense of, I don't know if it's sort of weary cynicism, is it scepticism? But it seems fairly prudent to adopt that sort of attitude. Is that what your sort of thoughts are on this broadly?
Generally, yes. But the precedents are not very encouraging. I'm a long-standing veteran of reporting meetings in Brussels, one of those world capitals of the activity where important men in suits sit around big tables and try and bore each other into submission during the middle of the night. And I can tell you that even the men around the table often don't know whether it's going to come out right, let alone anyone else. I mean, in this kind of agreement, the devil really is completely and entirely in the detail. I mean, obviously, clearly something has happened. It's not nothing. Somebody has said, look, we got further. This looks quite good. You'd better come. Hence all these foreign ministers flying into Geneva. Mm. But that does not mean the agreement is done.
And it's intriguing, isn't it, looking at the media view. And I know a number of the sort of more hardline Iranian news outlets have drawn comparisons between these talks and the talks from back in 2004 under Mohammad Khatami, and saying, you know, there was a very bitter deal struck then and it's the same now. It's funny that there's almost equal levels of cynicism on both sides, isn't it? What do you think, Matthew, is the way that the Americans can play this? We'll talk a bit more specifically about Israel in a moment. But how does Kerry manage expectation and manage his arrival at this meeting? Because it's almost impossible for him to deflect that sense of expectation.
Yeah. I mean, the Americans are actually in quite a pretty poor shape at the moment in the Middle East, really. And it's not just Israel that has a lot of issues to do with Iran and its nuclear program. Also, Saudi Arabia is extremely concerned with the growing influence of Iran in the region and the nuclear problem. And they're deeply, deeply unhappy with the Obama administration over its not taking military action against the Assad regime, and also in its willingness to look for a deal at the present time with Hassan Rouhani. It seems as if the Obama administration is really desperate to get a deal on this issue. And of course, you can understand that. We do want to get a deal because the alternative is really unimaginable. However, in their haste, I feel as though they are underplaying their hand, and their standing in the region is eroding. It's not necessarily American influence. It is just perhaps the standing of this particular administration. A new president could turn the situation around. But their stock in Israel, their stock throughout the region, especially in Saudi Arabia and with other allies, is actually going down. And they don't know whether they can rely on the United States anymore.
It must be quite alarming, I guess, for Washington, D.C. to be dealing with that. Is there a sense almost that he's starting to look slightly like a lame duck, Obama, when it comes to foreign policy? Because do you think people are now just thinking, well, let's hedge our bets, see what happens in 2016, maybe it'll be a different picture? Or is it too early, do you think, George, to even mention that?
I would just turn that upside down. There is a window now in which Obama, who cannot run for election again, could defend an agreement which he thought was viable and worth doing, but liable to be unpopular. He pays far less price than anyone else will be. A first-term president may want to run for a second. There's just a short window now where he has some extra political advantage. I don't disagree with Matthew and his general analysis of the fall of American influence. I think that's right. But there is one extra compensating advantage which Obama has, which is he has no stake in having to worry about the politics of it. If he thinks it's right, he can stand over it and say, I'm sorry, this is the best there is. All the alternatives are unthinkable. We should do it.
And there's no question that he and his advisors would have the political appetite, you think, for maybe taking that kind of step?
I certainly think, yes, he would very much like to get a deal. It would be a great boost to a foreign policy legacy, which is looking particularly shaky now in the Middle East. However, I would slightly disagree with George in the sense that the window is there and it's closing for him. But in terms of his own party, especially in Congress, I don't really see, if it's not a really good deal that Israel can buy into, I don't see many Democratic House of Representative members or senators backing it, because of course they have their re-elections next year, and then we're into the presidential campaign. If it is Hillary Clinton who is the nominee, she's taken a very hard line against Iran, and also the Democratic Party will not want to get into a confrontation with Israel's allies on Capitol Hill and lose perhaps some support from some of the American Jewish people who vote Democrat. So there is a window, but it will have to be a very good deal and one that reassures Israel for it to go forward.
We should also remember that, I mean, politics applies on the other side too. We have really no idea whether Rouhani, the new Iranian president, has the kind of clout, the juice, to get a deal through, which is potentially unpopular on his end. I doubt Rouhani even really knows what his capacities in that respect are.
Well, and there's certainly the possibility that he's rather hamstrung at the same time. I mean, who's really calling the shots in Iran, I suppose one could imagine. Let's talk a little bit more about Israel, though, specifically. Obviously, Benjamin Netanyahu immediately spoke out, as perhaps was predictable today. He's obviously very concerned. I'd be interested to sort of pick up on
Matthew mentioned having been in the country recently. I mean, is there a sense that it is inevitable that the other players in this are going to attempt to develop some kind of solution? Do you think there's an appetite in Israel to at least engage with the idea that they're going to have to come round to some form of talks or some form of deal? It's almost inevitable it's going to happen. But yeah. in Israel, there seems to be no willingness whatsoever to countenance any compromise at this stage.
I think there's certainly an appetite to try to get a deal, and there's an appetite to avoid at all costs military action. There was a split, quite unprecedented public dispute earlier this year between former heads of the Israeli intelligence services who came out and spoke very strongly in disagreement with the rhetoric and the positioning of the Prime Minister, saying that it would be, you know, the worst thing for Israel to have to take any kind of military action against Iran, or for any other country to have to take military action against Iran, especially when you think about the consequences that could unleash. I was up on the border with Lebanon, and I was in the very area where the second Lebanon war started in 2006 and where probably the third Lebanon war will start. There are 80,000 rockets in that area that have been shipped in from Iran to Hezbollah, and they could be unleashed at a moment's notice if there was a military confrontation with bombings in Iran on its nuclear facilities. So there's certainly an appetite to avoid that. However, there is no countenancing, as far as I could tell from my discussions with officials, that they could contemplate living with an Iran that had a nuclear bomb, in the sense of when Pakistan got nuclear weapons, we'd all been saying, no, they mustn't have this. And then it finally happened and we've been living with it ever since. But there's really, they're not even thinking about sort of containment and mutually assured destruction. They really want to avoid Iran having a nuclear weapons capability.
It's intriguing to think of the dynamics in these meetings. And, George, you sort of alluded to these meetings in Brussels with, I guess, these faceless bureaucrats, as we like to paint them, in their suits, sort of fruitlessly sitting for hours and hours in these kind of meetings. What do you think the dynamic is, you know, at a meeting like this in Geneva? Is there a sense that, as Matthew alluded to there, you know, without Israel, it's very difficult to see how America can push through something very concrete? Do you think there's will there be an air of futility? Or do you think that the key players will be, you know, more engaged with this, perhaps, than
No. I mean, there is surely serious work going on in the detail here. If you got inside the room, you would discover two things. One is very large numbers of sheets of paper, because this is about words. It really is about details. It's about where commas are sometimes. So there's a lot of very, very detailed text work going on. The other thing is people are on the phone the whole time. They're on the phone mostly back home to make sure that what they're doing, if they're shifting their position, that everybody back home knows how they're shifting it, how far they're shifting it, in which direction, and nobody is taking the skids out from underneath them while they're doing it. But that's what most of this discussion is really usually about. It's not kind of across the table. It's people exchanging versions of, if I said this in the last paragraph, could you live with that? If you tell me you can live with that, I'll tell them back home, and then we can see whether we got something.
So it's really the sort of minutiae that's interesting. I want to move on now. It's a sort of endlessly fascinating topic, but let's talk about another area where the devil is very much in the detail. The world of espionage, spying. Obviously, we've talked in a great deal on Monocle 24 about these recent spats, the NSA and so forth. An intriguing development in London this week. We had just today the chiefs of all Britain's three major intelligence services hauled over the coals before a televised parliamentary committee, which was a delicious enough spectacle in itself. We had Andrew Parker from MI5, Sir John Swords from MI6, and I think most intriguingly, perhaps, the GCHQ director, Sir Ian Lobban. Matthew, what did you make of the spectacle, I guess, of this, first of all? Because we're not really still used to seeing that in this country.
No, I mean, it was intriguing. It was like something out of a James Bond film, you know, seeing the three of them there. You can just imagine, you know, sort of a scene like with Judi Dench's M and so on. And it was unprecedented. This is very much
such a PR sort of counteroffensive against the Edward Snowden leaks, I think they've probably felt as though they really have to launch some kind of public response because they have been quite slow in counteracting this, and now there's sort of, you know, the wheels are swinging into action and they're coming out a little bit more public. It was fascinating to hear them speak in Parliament like that, the three of them together. I, of course, heard Andrew Parker just a few weeks ago give his first public lecture.
Which was very controversial, of course, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It was controversial. I mean, he didn't actually mention Edward Snowden once in his lecture by name, and it was just a sort of an overview of the media. But they're certainly coming out swinging, just as the Prime Minister last week was saying, you know, if newspapers don't show more social responsibility, that there could be legal actions taken.
It was an intriguing spectacle. George, I wonder, I mean, it's interesting Matthew says there about sort of PR overdrive that all of these bodies have gone into. What did you make of it from a media perspective? Did you sort of think, wow, this is just about the presentation, it's putting on a front? Or did you think there was some more substance? At least that was perhaps one of the objectives from the committee who were sort of doing the grilling.
Well, to be honest, there wasn't really much more substance in public. I agree that it is very interesting and, of course, unprecedented that they all appeared yesterday in front of this committee. But the public session, one of the problems about parliamentary committees is every MP on the committee is more or less entitled to their go in the limelight. So there is never any consistent questioning by a single person, which almost anyone who's ever questioned anybody will tell you is the only way of actually getting anything interesting out of someone. So it's no great surprise that they didn't really lay a glove on them. And of course, it's hardly surprising that they were extremely well prepared and careful. But in terms of the substance of their case, it didn't seem to me that they said anything that they hadn't said before. And either you take their word for it, or you say, well, hang on a minute, in a democracy, things are under law. Privacy is surely a matter of law. You can't just say, trust us, fly with us, it's all safe. Well, I don't think you can. And so they didn't really convince me, fascinated as I was, to see them under the lights, so to speak.
Absolutely. Well, I just wondered very briefly on this before we move on then. Whose job, if we're not perhaps getting the answers that we are entitled to ask for, it's incumbent upon who then to make those demands? I mean, should the press stand up to some of the scrutiny, that some of the criticism they've had from some of these intelligence chiefs and say, well, look, we're actually holding people to account. The public has a right to know. They're paying, essentially funding all of these operations. Do you think the media should be more robust in its defence?
Personally, I think it should. And I'm amazed by the contrast between the discussion that has gone on in America and the one that has gone on in Britain. In America, where people tend to see things in rights-based terms, you know, the media, and not just the media, quite a lot of politicians, said, you know, it is the NSA, they're talking about the American agency there, you know, was operating on this industrial surveillance scale and on autopilot, and that's wrong. And there have been relatively few people in Britain who've said that, and I've honestly been surprised that that's the case. I think somebody said this week, you know, instead of an American rights-based approach in Britain, we have a wrongs-based approach. We wait until something goes grievously wrong, and then when we're really convinced that it's terribly wrong, we'll try and fix it. I think there's something in that, but I do think that there is a very slow accumulation in British public opinion of people of floating middle opinion, just thinking, well, these guys we saw yesterday, the agency chiefs, they're clearly conscientious, serious public servants. But are we really just going to take the whole thing on trust forever on the scale that they can now do this? I just think most people are thinking, I think there's going to have to be a better way, you know, guys. You're going to have to tell us more, or you're going to have to convince us better, or somebody's going to work out something that's better. Stella Remington, who used to be the head of MI5, said very early on in this controversy, she said, look, I don't think the spy agencies are doing anything wrong. Don't mistake me. But if the supervision isn't convincing people, the agencies themselves have got a problem and they should help fix it.
Very brief, Matthew. Do you sort of go along? You were sort of nodding away there. Do you largely go along with that?
Yes, but I also feel as though there should be a greater role for politicians to ensure that there is greater oversight and control, because it seems to me, especially in America, that this the intelligence complex has just, you know, grown out of control. And I don't think even President Obama was aware that Angela Merkel's phone was being bugged, and that tells you a lot.
Absolutely. Intriguing stuff. And George Brock and Matthew Jameson will both be here when we return in just a moment. We'll be talking about newspapers again, a slightly different side, maybe the design of them. Do stay tuned.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavours of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me are George Brock from City University and the author of Out of Print, and Matthew Jameson from London-based think tank RUSI. We're going to keep talking about the media now. The Independent newspaper here in the UK has undergone a major redesign. Worryingly, some might say the fifth in 5 years. Is it good? Is it bad? George and Matthew, I'll get your thoughts in just a second. Let's hear, first of all, though, in brief from our editor, Andrew Tuck, and our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. I asked them for their views on this redesign a little earlier.
It's a tussle that's going on in all newspapers, but which seems to have come to the fore much quicker at The Independent, which is the decision about whether you are a newspaper, i.e. you're just breaking news, trying to tell people stories that are happening that day, or whether the print version of what you do these days should be analysis and the web should be news. And they've certainly taken a big step towards being a newspaper of analysis, contemplation, and the news reduced to almost internet kind of bite-sized pieces dotted throughout the paper.
The person that's done this redesign is is normally a magazine designer. It's a consultant called Matt Wise, very good magazine designer. And it's interesting that you would choose a magazine designer over someone with more newspaper experience. But obviously it ties in perhaps with what Andrew's saying there, that they're making this thing a little bit more analysis-like. And I think one of the things about the redesign is it does feel quite magazine-y. To return to the point about five redesigns in 5 years, that's not a good sign to me. It seems a bit schizophrenic, and I think it's people hitting the panic button. I don't know the full story. Maybe they've had change of staff. But to me, I think you redesign, you reinvent because you want to get sales, and that is an indication, I think, of maybe what they're worried about. Overall, with the redesign, I think credit to them because they have taken it very seriously. They've commissioned all new fonts. They've got in an outside consultant, Matt Wiley, and I think they've done a fairly decent job, but I think to me, I'm not sure whether there's too many fonts in there. Mm. And I think actually nothing really, really jumps out.
At least I think there's a little bit more elegance than the design that went before. And in their favour, the print media world is changing so fast, you can understand why they have had to redesign again. Perhaps five is too many. Just one tiny thing. When I was there, the editor was Simon Kellner, and I remember him doing a redesign of the paper. He said, the one thing you don't mess up is moving the cryptic crossword, because people get very cross if it moves. They've moved the page that it's on, so I'm sure there's going to be a few people about that. But you also have to make sure there's a little bit of space for them to kind of work out their answers, and I see that they've done that.
That's Andrew Tuck and Richard Spence Powell, Monocle's editor and creative director, respectively, on The Independent. George, I should start with you. Do you go along with that? What do you make of this? I mean, is Richard right? Is it a bit schizophrenic? Five in 5 years? Is this just bad news? Or do you think that there's something commendable in what The Independent's tried to do?
No, you can't honestly say that there is anything but an admission of failure if you're redesigning your paper five times in 5 years. I know exactly what Andrew means about the crossword. I once shaved a centimetre off the size of the crossword in the Times. It was in the same place, on the same page. My office nearly disappeared under the mail. People get very attached to things, but the problem, of course, of The Independent is that it's got very few people who are attached to it. And what it's got is a younger sister, this paper I, 20p, very popular with the young, which is basically just eating up its success. It uses the material from The Independent, and The Independent's readership is in circulation is just gradually dwindling. And I actually quite, as a piece of design, I think this is really quite nice. I hated the previous design, so almost anything was going to work for me, and I think a lot of this does. But is it going to make any difference? Not likely.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? If we try not to be too doom and gloom about our printed products. If anything, we're the exact opposite. But there is certainly a problem, as you say, if readership numbers continue to tumble. I wonder what do you think it would take to win you back as a reader? I mean, perhaps you were formerly, I don't know, do you see enough there? Perhaps this more magazine-y format, so less actual news, a bit more analysis. Is that a format that can work, or does it strike you also as being largely a desperate throw of the dice, perhaps?
Well, they seem to have taken Trotsky's adage of a permanent revolution to heart. I agree with George. Actually, I quite like the set out. It is quite striking with the picture, the slap bang in the front, and so on. But I think that really what they need to do is they need to bring in more international affairs coverage and really break out of any kind of sort of parochialism. And go for top quality analysis. But that's not going to happen in terms of just, fiddling around with the layout and so on. And the big problem is, of course, their circulation is way down to about 42,000. And it's this onslaught of the digital age, and the internet is really actually going to the very heart of the need for actual newspapers.
George, just finally on this, obviously you've written extensively about this, and it's something of a recurring theme, I think, when we talk. But are we wrong to suggest that this is symptomatic of a wider malaise, or is it simply the fact that some of these titles maybe don't have the power to endure, but we shouldn't necessarily be sort of heralding the final demise of the printed product? Is it just still a marketplace that has one or two or three too many players in it? Or are there genuine sort of mistakes perhaps that somebody, at Independent Towers is still making?
Look, first of all, there's no big crisis of print in general. This is specifically a problem about the business model of general interest daily papers. And particularly national papers, which used to have big costs. Now, among those, there have always been more people who want to enter the market than the market is actually going to keep. So there's always a national paper which is clinging to the top of the cliff by its fingertips. That's been the Independent now for some years, and their position has just got worse because everybody's position has got worse. Once broadband household broadband rate got to about 60% in Britain, and tablets came in, which happened to be more or less simultaneous, the rates of circulation decline among all the big papers really began to accelerate. And they've gone on accelerating, and that just makes the problems tougher. It doesn't mean that printed people are going to stop reading in print. They're going to read books. They're going to read magazines. They're going to read weekly things. They may even be printed on newsprint if they can make the business model work. It's just that printed daily papers on a big, big scale that everybody reads and knows about, they're just going to be a much smaller part of the spectrum than they were.
Food for thought, indeed. I hope some of these newspaper publishers are listening to George Brock. That was George Brock and Matthew Jameson. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us at Midori House on today's Aperitivo.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come. In the second half of today's Aperitivo, we'll be heading to the Monocle Cafe to talk Korean film, and we'll chat with British DJ Rob DeBank, and we'll preview what's coming up on the rest of today's programmes, of course. Before we get started on all of that, though, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley, who has the latest world news headlines.
Tom, thanks very much. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has joined international talks on Iran's nuclear programme. The United States has offered to ease sanctions on Iran if the country takes concrete, verifiable steps to show it's not developing nuclear weapons. 12 million people in the Philippines are thought to be at risk as a powerful typhoon strikes that country. 3 people are known to have died, and at least 1 million have been evacuated, and communications have been badly disrupted. Germany and Brazil have submitted a resolution to the United Nations General Assembly calling for an end to invasive internet scrutiny and other invasions of privacy. It follows revelations about a US-led spying program, including claims the phone calls of both countries' leaders were intercepted. And the Dutch King, Willem-Alexander, has arrived in Moscow ahead of a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, as ties between the countries have been tested by the arrests of Greenpeace activists and also Russia's homosexual propaganda law. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. More news from Jonathan Wheatley, of course, at the top of the next hour. Right now on Aperitivo, though, the time is 21:34 in Moscow, 18:34 here in London, which means it's time to head just out of our office, round the corner, a few yards down Chilton Street, to the Monocle Cafe. In today's show, we are meeting Kim Dong-ho, the founder of the Busan Film Festival, one of Asia's biggest film events. Mr. Kim is in town for the opening of the London Korean Film Festival, which launched yesterday, in which his directorial debut will be screened. It's called Jury, a satirical comedy about film festivals and award ceremonies. Kim is also himself the subject of a new documentary called Ongoing Smile by the Iranian director Mohsen Makhmobaf. Monocle's producer, Daphne Denny, met up with Mr. Kim at the Monocle Cafe a little earlier. Daphne asked what led him to create the Busan Film Festival.
I had been attended the International Film Festival in 1988. The Montreal Film Festival and the 1989 Moscow Film Festival. So I recognized that the film festival will be contributed to promote of their films. So I think International Film Festival might be need in Korea. So in 1995, the few of the professors at universities in Busan, they organized the International Film Festival in Busan, and they asked to me to be a festival director and established the International Film Festival in Busan with them. So I involved them. So we were preparing to establish International Film Festival in Busan. So we founded the International Film Festival. And we are confident that the Busan International Film Festival will be contributed to promote Korean films and will be introduced Korean films to the overseas through the film festival. So we founded, and so we had been contributed to Korean film industry to the overseas.
But what makes Korean films special compared to, I don't know, French films, English films, American films? What's the specificity of Korean films and filmmaking?
I think that the Korean films were making on the basis of a typical Korean culture. It's a different, the Western culture and Oriental cultures. So many of Western peoples, or the people of America, they find out the typical Korean cultures through Korean films. So it's, I guess it's a different criteria between the Western films and Korean films.
Your film Jury is being shown at the London Korean Film Festival right now. And I was wondering, I mean, your film Jury is a satire of film festivals and critics. So are you biting the hand that's been feeding you for all these years? Are you just laughing at basically what you've been doing for quite a while?
After step down the Busan International Film Festival, I would like to make the short or long feature films, because I had many experiences to operating and the film festivals. Especially, I had experiences as a jury members of many international film festivals, more than 30 times. And also, among them, I was the president of jury So I had, I think I had many experiences about a deliberation of jury.
What's the conclusion that you're trying to draw with this short film?
In my short films, I didn't conclude the decision. So the all of the process of deliberation was one of the dream. So I didn't any final decisions of that film, so only the process of deliberating. So they are fighting.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
That was Korean director Kim Dong-ho with Monocle's Daphne Denny at the Monocle Cafe a little earlier. I don't know about you, but that's very much put me in the mood to hear a little Korean music right about now. So without further delay, let's hear from Third Line Butterfly. This is Let's Talk. That's the unmistakable sound of Let's Talk by Third Line Butterfly. And for all you musical aficionados out there, I've got another great tune to play you a little bit later in the programme. Up next on the show, though, Monocle's Fernando Pacheco will be meeting DJ Rob DeBank. Stay tuned on Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Tom Edwards. London is hosting this weekend a new major electronic music festival founded by Radio 1 DJ Rob DeBank and music pioneer and International Music Summit creator Ben Turner. The festival will host a series of talks, including appearances by legendary disco producer Giorgio Moroder and also New Order. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with Rob DeBank, who spoke more about the festival and a bit more about the future of electronic music.
Yeah. It's called LEAF, which stands for London Electronic Arts Festival. It's a London-based festival celebrating electronic music and how that ties into the arts. So, yeah, there's some club culture, there's a lot of gigs, but there's also things like Dinos Chapman, you know, doing art installation, and, you know, I'm doing a rescoring of a film and stuff. So it's going across all the media, so hopefully it's not too intellectual, it's not too highbrow, but it's not just clubs and banging raves. It's hopefully showing that electronic music has got such an amazing history and reflecting that, really.
And also, what a lineup as well. I mean, New Order, Giorgio Moroder, how did you manage to curate that?
Yeah, well, it's me and my manager Ben. We kind of had the idea of doing this, and we teamed up with our friends SJM, who are like one of the biggest promoters in the UK, and so it's just been a sort of pooling of resources and ideas, and we've just kind of had a hit list and a dream list, and we've gone out to a lot of them, and Giorgio was actually, you know, top of one of those lists that some people we didn't get this year. Hopefully, you know, we can get them next year. So we wanted to be very diverse, you know, we didn't want just one style, so we've got everything from Omar Suleiman and, you know, kind of Syrian rave through to Giorgio through to Trent Moller, and yeah, it's very diverse, lots of different nationalities represented.
If I may ask, maybe it's a bit too early, but are you planning to do this every year or maybe every 2 years? Or
no, it's an annual festival, so this space that we're in now, the hub, you know, this is kind of, if they'll have us back, this is where we'll always have our base, and you know, this is where a lot of the talks and a lot of the art happens, and then we use venues all around London.
And I wonder, what are the different challenges? Because I know you're the founder of Bestival as well. When you do a festival in a city like London or in the fields, what are the differences?
Yeah, I'd say this is probably a bit easier because obviously you're working in venues that they're weatherproof. You know, you don't have to worry about the weather. The systems are already all in place for ticketing and bars, and you know, so there's a lot less infrastructure that you need. You don't need to build a festival from scratch here. It's kind of here already, and the people are here. You know, we're in a city of 16, 20 million, whatever. So the people are here. So you've got your audience.
What is the importance of London in the global electronic music scene? Was it a very influential city?
Well, you know, this is where Acid House was born. So it's I don't think you could say electronic music was invented in London, but it's certainly, you know, it's been a huge player, you know, one of the top three along with New York and Chicago. And yeah, I mean, you know, London is absolutely vital to the electronic industry, you know, electronic music industry, and people love playing here. You know, you get a really very discerning kind of clubber, but also, you know, people that are really heavily into their music. And we love it here.
I know you also have a label, but I want to talk a little bit about the future of electronic music. Do you see any kind of trends coming up or any artists that might be everywhere, like in the next few years?
Well, I think, you know, if we're talking about electronic music, then what's happened in the last 10 years and particularly even the last 5 years is that electronic music has sort of seeped into so many different styles of music. So, you know, some of the rock music and indie music has kind of taken on bits of electronic music. You know, you look at bands like Friendly Fires or even Queens of the Stone Age, and you know, that you can hear more electronics in their shows. And then you look at new acts like Lord or acts like that, and they are heavily, you know, influenced by electronic music. James Blake, you know, who's a singer, but his music is underpinning is all electronic. So I think, you know, your 16-year-old kids, your 18-year-olds, they are growing up with a really great, very mature kind of electronic sound that maybe when I was a kid, you know, it was kind of pop electronic and sort of disco, and you know, it was a bit more throwaway. But now that electronic strand just runs through so many different styles of music, which is great.
That was DJ Rob DeBank with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco a little earlier. And, I think we should play some music inspired by that meeting, inspired by that conversation. A man who was mentioned indeed in that conversation, Giorgio Moroder, the legend. And here in the studio with me is Fernando Pacheco. Fernando, I think you should introduce the Giorgio Moroder track that you've selected.
Non mi chiamo Fernando, mi chiamo Giorgio Ton. Yeah, shall we listen to my favourite track? From Here to Eternity, an amazing song.
That was the unmistakable sound of Giorgio Moroder, of course, with From Here to Eternity. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're ticking towards the end of the programme, but we're going to catch up with exactly what we have to look forward to on tonight's shows. I'm still with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'm also joined by Barbara Feeney, who's going to tell us a little bit more about her programme as well in just a second. But Fernando, I have to start with you. Music to your ears. You must have...
What a song.
It's a classic, isn't it?
It's one of the best songs of the 20th century, I have to say.
I think Giorgio Moroder doesn't quite get the credit that he deserves. I know in aficionados are, you know, always full of praise, but maybe in the mainstream, he doesn't get the credit.
Not really, but I think now he's getting more credit, you know, especially after, you know, the Daft Punk, you know, they did in the latest album, they even gave a song to Giorgio called Giorgio, you know. I mean, to be honest, it was not my favorite track of the album. It's quite slow. It's not like From Here to Eternity or I Feel Love or, you know, other classic songs.
So many classics.
So many classics. Yeah, exactly.
Wonderful stuff. And good to, you know, sort of electronic music generally in Rude Health, your chat with Rob DeBank. Intriguing. It's the boom time for electronica, yeah?
Exactly. And I mean, if you look at the charts, even rhythms like, you know, hip-hop or rock, they use some elements of electronic music. So nowadays, everything's more mixed. So yeah, electronic music's conquering it all.
That's good news, I think. Right, let's talk a little bit about this evening's programmes. Barbara, I felt you were a little left out of that electronica chat. So why don't you tell us what exactly we've got coming up on your show this evening?
Well, Tom, to begin, we are in China because tomorrow the Chinese leaders are meeting for the third plenum meeting. So this is a big deal because they're going to kind of set out economic and, you know, political policies that they're going to focus on during their term. And it's a secret meeting, so we don't actually know what's going to be on the agenda, but there's a lot of speculation. So we're going to speculate.
Wrong with a bit of speculation now and again, Barbara.
There is, you know, we can speculate and, you know, see what they're going to talk about.
Exactly. I was going to say, if they're keeping it secret, they've not done a great job because we all know about it. But as you were saying, the substance, of course, will be up for discussion. But it's always interesting, isn't it? Often the key players who makes a name for themselves at these events within the Chinese Communist Party is often more interesting even than the actual substance of what emerges. So there's all sorts of interesting people watching dynamics that go on
exactly.
as well.
It's going to be a big few days for Xi Jinping.
Fascinating. Where else are we going to be heading
then
on our
whistle stop
tour?
We're staying in Asia. We're in Japan then, because a young MP gave a letter to the emperor when he was in the imperial palace, and this has caused huge uproar because it's just complete taboo, and you know people have been calling for him to resign. So we're going to kind of take a step back and look at kind of the etiquette related to the whole royal family. And it should be quite an interesting discussion.
Intriguing stuff.
Yeah.
We're ticking off all the boxes on our Globus Asia show, of course. Any other things that you draw our listeners' attention to? Because they're going to be they're wrapped already.
My favorite story, Tom.
Oh, what's this going to be?
Because it's about Barbie.
Ah, what's she been up to?
Barbie in China. But Mattel, the makers of Barbie, they are trying to kind of refresh their image in China because, you know, recently one of their six-story stores shut down. So they're kind of trying to appeal to Chinese, their Chinese audience. And they've now launched a Barbie who plays the violin. So they're kind of looking to make Barbie be more educated and
tailoring her cultural Barbie for all different destinations.
It's not just a toy.
It is not indeed. It's a cultural icon. What about a Brazilian Barbie? Does that exist already, Fernando? I don't know.
No, I think Barbies are quite popular in Brazil. Maybe I should create one.
This is a lucrative avenue.
I'm very curious to listen to that, actually, Barbara. You know, it should be a fun item.
Absolutely. Well, Fernando, let's talk a little bit about the review, of course. More Great Radio coming up this weekend. What are the particular highlights we should be looking out for?
There'll be a lot of fun stuff on the review tomorrow. You know, our regular film critic, Karen Krizanovich, is going to be here. And among the films she's going to review, she's going to review Gravity. I mean, which everyone's talking about. It's been released in the US already. Has a UK release today. And actually, the funny thing, Karen actually had a role in the film, which I'm not going to tell you now. You have to listen to the review tomorrow.
So tantalizing, Fernando. I want to know what.
Because the critics saying that it's one of the films that's going to change the history of cinema. To be honest, I've seen Gravity, you know. I liked it, but you know, I didn't thought it was kind of the best ever. But it's a good film anyway.
That's good. Important to have different opinions always.
I think George Clooney is a bit annoying, I have to say, sometimes.
Oh, Fernando, you're a very impatient man.
Sorry,
Karen will be joining us. We love to hear from her.
We love her.
Any other particular highlights that you'd mark out?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, first of all, our lovely managing editor, David Michonne, he wrote, because we have a new segment on the review, a short review, where a member of our staff or one of our correspondents write a review about something they like. And you know, Michonne is going to talk about a new trend of granny chic.
I can see that he'd be into that.
Which I totally support. You know, there's a new exhibition by photographer Tim Walker about, you know, with lovely elderly women dressed in an amazing way. There's documentaries about it. So it's a topic that's really, it's very 2013, I have to say.
I like it. Bring us up to date. Granny chic. Barbara, what do you reckon?
Love it. I've seen some of these pictures and it's really lovely, Tom.
Oh, fantastic.
It's quite touching. I'm not going to use the word cute because I think that's quite patronising.
We don't want to be patronising.
It's lovely.
It's chic and lovely.
Beautiful stuff. That is all coming up this weekend on Monocle 24 and later this evening indeed. If you want to find out more about all these programmes, of course, make sure you don't miss any. You can always go to monocle.com or at iTunes and listen again at your leisure. Barbara, Fernando, thank you both for joining me here on Aperitivo. That's all we have time for on today's show, I'm sorry to say. Particular thanks to my special guest today, George Brock and Matthew Jameson. Today's show was expertly produced, as always, by Daniel Giacopelli, effortlessly research by Maddie Arouge, and our studio manager was the always calm Chris Chilvers. At 20:00 hours London time, be sure to tune in to the Globalist Asia. Monocle Daily follows that as well at 20:00 London time. Aperitivo will be back at the very same time on Monday, but for this edition of the programme, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
From London
to Zurich
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Beijing
to Sao Paulo
nach Amsterdam
a Bogota
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.